An exiled opposition leader from Belarus wants the rest of the world to not forget what's happening in her home country.
We have more than 1,200 political prisoners at the moment in Belarus. More than 500,000 had to flee the country because of repressions.
I'm Marco Werman. Today we hear from Belarusian dissident Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. Also, the Trump administration is said to be holding talks with officials in Cuba about the future of the island.
Cuba, if it is negotiating with the United States at this point, is negotiating with a U.S. dagger at its heart.
And why a new bridge between the U.S. and Canada has become a political flashpoint.
We've got family and friends that work on both sides of the border and live on both sides of the border. And it really is one community.
All those stories and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here this Wednesday. Opposition leaders across the globe are fighting authoritarian governments from abroad. Many of them are gathering right now in Geneva, Switzerland, for a summit on human rights and democracy. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is among them. She's a 43-year-old mother and a former English teacher. Turmoil in her home country of Belarus catapulted her into a presidential run in 2020, and then she had to flee the country ruled by strongman Alexander Lukashenko. She leads the Belarusian opposition from exile now in Lithuania. If that's not dramatic enough, her husband, the pro-democracy blogger Sergei Tikhanovsky, was imprisoned when she fled. He's been staging a return to politics in Belarus since being released last year. We start the show today with Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who began our conversation with a plea to the international community.
We have more than 1,200 political prisoners at the moment in Belarus. More than 500,000 had to flee the country because of repressions. And I just encourage democratic institutions, democratic countries to work more effectively on such cases as in Belarus. You have power to release the people. You have power to punish dictators and avoid impunity. So don't lose focus and don't allow impunity for dictators.
So there's a growing number of people who have contested elections going into exile instead of taking office. I'm thinking Edmundo Gonzalez from Venezuela. What is the value in opposition from abroad?
Look, of course, influence from abroad has limits. You know, we are not inside country. We do not control institutions. We do not command security forces. But change in Belarus will be made by Belarusians. Only people can bring down the regime. Of course, international support can play a decisive role. But from abroad, we can build international coalitions. We can advocate for sanctions and close loopholes. We can push for accountability in international courts, secure support for civil society and independent media. We also maintain direct communication with the people inside the country. Weekly calls, online meetings, secure channels. Even small contact is important so that people do not feel isolated. But we're honest about the limits. We cannot organize street protests from abroad. We cannot protect every activist from repression. We cannot substitute the will of the people. But I think that people inside the country, they understand that it's under such huge repressions, people have to resist underground. Being in exile, we really can promote Belarusian cause to keep focus on Belarus.
So specifically, what pressure, if any, does Alexander Lukashenko have to contend with in Belarus?
In Belarus, every day people are detained, 8-10 people daily. The number of political prisoners now more than 1,200. And there is no necessity to repress people because many of them fled Belarus, many already in prisons. But Lukashenko needs terror to seed fear. He wants to show Putin that I'm controlling situation. You know, I'm boss here.
We seem to be seeing a kind of normalization of Alexander Lukashenko. The Trump administration invited the current Belarusian government to be a member of the Board of Peace, Russia as well. What does that signal to you? That they were invited?
So first of all, I wouldn't call it normalization of the situation or legitimization of the regime. Of course, we are grateful to President Trump and John Cole, special envoy in Belarus, for holding this humanitarian track that helped us to release about 200 people. But it's no change of the policy of Lukashenko. He is continuing to terrorize Belarusians and to detain new people. It's like revolving doors at the moment. Look, Board of Peace is concept. And while inviting Lukashenko, I doubt that President Trump was thinking that how Lukashenko might be useful in the solution of Gaza problem. But we see already that Lukashenko will not go to Washington for this first meeting because I think that his master Putin didn't allow him. But it's important only for dictators. Dictators, they're bragging about this. They, with this invitation, they're trying to advocate or lobby in Europe that, look, Europe, you have to copy Trump's policy, just communicating to us. But President Trump, he fulfills concrete humanitarian aim in Belarus to release political prisoners. It's not about perceiving Lukashenko's legitimate rule of the country.
I'm speaking with Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. Madam, whom do you see as your main source of support at this point?
First of all, it's Belarusian people. You know, without confidence that Belarusians are not giving up, without the confidence in their support to my actions, I think that I would be exhausted long time ago. But when I visit in different countries, talking to presidents, prime ministers, of course, we have to ask for help and ask for assistance. Of course, sometimes it's humiliating to ask, but it's very important to understand that Belarus is not only a humanitarian disaster or internal political conflict, it's read about security. And when you're helping Belarusians, you're not providing charity to us. You're investing into your own security and security of your countries.
So your husband, Sergei Tikhanovsky, was released from jail in Belarus last year. He's since returned to politics. And in an interview with the French newspaper Le Monde in December, he said that your team has, quote, failed to achieve its main objectives, Lukashenko's departure, new elections, and closer ties with the EU. That is why this opposition, which emerged after 2020, is becoming obsolete, end quote. Has this been constructive in dialogue around next steps, or has it been problematic?
I have to say that all political prisoners who are released, they need some time, you know, to realize what has been happening for 5 years. Of course, we would like to dismantle this regime 5 years ago already and get people released from prisons 5 years ago. But the situation is like it is now. The war has started and some people think that if we, for example, lift sanctions, Lukashenko will be so happy that he will release people. But it's not happening with dictators like this. And of course, I understand that people, when times are difficult, they are looking for those who are responsible. They are looking for those who are guilty. Of course, if I took responsibility 5 years ago to be with people until free and fair elections, until everybody is released, so I'm continuing this path, despite very shrinked possibilities.
Your husband has proposed abandoning EU integration in favor of something like Finland's kind of neutrality because he fears Belarus would become another Ukraine. Are you saying that your husband is saying things that he doesn't mean, that he's under pressure to say you failed and to propose things like this?
No, definitely, you know, my husband is not under pressure. I think that people looking for concepts or tools, you know, strategies or policies different from mine, for example, because 5 years passed and it looks like Lukashenko is still there, political prisoners are still there, and they are looking for new forms of achieving the goals. And then we are working with these people. We are trying to explain that Finlandization that Sergei mentioned, you know, will not work because this is not what we want. We have to put goals that are in the interests of Belarus. And neutrality is not in the interest of Belarus, maybe on some particular step, but we want to return to European family of nations.
Yeah, so is there room for these differences over course of action?
Of course there is. You know, we are building democracy. We shouldn't suppress different opinions, but through dialogue, through communication, through explanations, we can find the best solution.
Svetlana Tikhanovskaya spoke with us from the Geneva Summit for Human Rights and Democracy. As the U.S. and Canada prepare for the gold medal game of Olympic women's hockey in Milan this week, there's another major showdown unfolding between the two countries, one that is not taking place on the ice but does involve hockey, the Gordie Howe International Bridge, named after the Canadian hockey legend who played for the Detroit Red Wings. It's supposed to open to international traffic between Michigan and the province of Ontario this year, but the grand opening is now caught up in the spat between the U.S. and Canada. Our transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel, has the latest on the situation.
If I'd have told you a decade ago that a bridge would be one of the biggest threats to U.S.-Canada relations, you'd have said I was bonkers. But that was a different time.
No other neighbors in the entire world are as fundamentally linked as we are.
Former Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau speaking there in 2017 after his first official meeting with President Trump during his first run in the White House. The two reaffirmed their country's deep diplomatic ties and discussed a shared focus on building things, in particular, a new bridge between the U.S. and Canada.
America is deeply fortunate to have a neighbor like Canada. We have before us the opportunity to build even more bridges, and bridges of cooperation, and bridges of commerce.
The president tossed his support behind a long-sought effort to build a new link between Detroit, Michigan, and Windsor, Ontario, the busiest international trade crossing in North America. Flash forward 8 years, and a lot of things have changed, while others haven't. Construction on the project is nearly complete. Justin Trudeau is out of office and dating Katy Perry, and President Trump is back in the Oval Office. Only now, rather than championing the bridge, he's become its biggest threat.
More drama tonight in the battle over opening the new Gordie Howe Bridge. Congressional Democrats say they are launching an investigation into President Trump's threat to delay the opening over potential conflict of interest.
Last week, in a lengthy rant about the bridge posted to Truth Social, the president said Canada is taking advantage of America, that the U.S. must be fully compensated for the bridge, that the U.S. should own half of it, and that he plans to block the bridge's opening without Canadian concessions. The statement was perplexing for people on both sides of the border, given the fact that Canada did, in fact, fully pay for the $6 billion bridge. And that it's already jointly owned by Canada and Michigan. Amid the confusion, Trump's press secretary Caroline Leavitt attempted to clarify his comments.
The fact that Canada will control what crosses the Gordie Howe Bridge and owns the land on both sides is unacceptable to the president.
Heather Grondin with the Windsor-Detroit Bridge Authority, the Canadian nonprofit that's overseeing construction and operation of the bridge, told me that statement raised more questions than it answered.
I'm not sure what was meant by the statement of Canada will control, so I can't speak to that. In terms of Canada owning the land, Canada owns the land on the Canadian side and Michigan owns the land on the U.S. side.
The White House did not return my requests for comments seeking clarity on the president's opposition and what concessions he'd like from Canada. Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney has been positive but measured in his comments about the situation, telling media last week he spoke with Trump on the phone and reiterated that Canada footed the bill and that he's looking forward to the bridge's opening. Still, the spat has spooked some stakeholders in the Detroit-Windsor area. One business leader on the Canadian side canceled an interview with me after Trump's comments over fears of fanning a political firestorm. Others, like Glenn Stevens Jr., have been vocal in their support of the project despite Trump's threats.
This bridge is a crucial modernization for the busiest commerce corridor between the U.S. and Canada.
Stevens, who heads up the Detroit Regional Chamber's automotive industry wing, tells me opening the bridge is a nonpartisan issue, one that's received support from three presidential administrations, two prime ministers, and two governors over the course of 3 decades.
So we've been working at this for a long time. And in essence, it really is to protect and enable the trade between our two countries, to strengthen the security and border control between our two countries, and to enable our long-term competitiveness.
On the Canadian side, Gordon Orr says Windsor and Detroit are inextricably linked, and not just through trade.
We've always promoted this region as a two-nation destination.
Orr is CEO of Invest Windsor Essex, a Canadian nonprofit focused on promoting business and tourism in the area.
We've got family and friends that work on both sides of the border and live on both sides of the border, and it really is one community.
Orr's not too concerned about Trump's threats to prevent the bridge from opening, because he says the interdependency between the U.S. and Canada is stronger than any single presidential administration. And what he's really concerned about is whether Canada can take home gold in women's hockey. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. He was the voice of the opposition in Vladimir Putin's Russia until 2 years ago this week. That's when Alexei Navalny died in a Russian penal colony in the Arctic. There are many questions about the state of the political opposition in Russia today. Navalny's anti-corruption foundation once maintained a vast network of offices from Moscow to Siberia aimed at exposing graft and supporting opposition politicians. That is all gone now. But many Russians who worked with Navalny are carrying on from exile. Reporter Levi Bridges has our story.
A couple of years ago, I spent an evening with a group of Russian anti-war activists in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. They were holding a wine tasting in their office to raise money for Ukrainian refugees. The vibe was relaxed, music playing, Russian dissidents just chatting and drinking wine by crates of medical supplies for Ukrainians. It felt like a place of safety and refuge. Listening back to that evening now and remembering all these people together feels eerie today. One of the volunteers who worked in that office is now locked up in prison, waiting to be extradited to Russia on false charges, her supporters say. Her name is Yulia Yemelyanova. She previously volunteered with Alexei Navalny's offices in St. Petersburg. Like many Russian activists, Yemelyanova left Russia because it was becoming more dangerous. She was eventually put on Russia's wanted list. Last summer, she was detained on a layover in the transit hall of an airport in Kazakhstan. She's been held in pretrial detention ever since. Russia now wants to extradite Yemelyanova for a small crime she allegedly committed in Russia years ago, stealing a phone worth about $100. Her lawyer, Murat Adam, tells me over the phone that her case is clearly fabricated. This extradition is really about her work with Navalny. He says Yemelyanova receives good treatment in detention, but she suffers from psychological stress. Adam says the last time he visited her, Yemelyanova was crying. She told him she's afraid of getting sent back to Russia and tortured. Other Russian activists I spoke with who know Yemelyanova personally didn't want to give their names. One woman tells me Yemelyanova is the sensitive type, a vegetarian who used to help stray cats, and she always felt like she wasn't doing enough to help others. Yemelyanova lived in Georgia for a couple years. She left last summer to start over in Southeast Asia. That's when she got detained. She was one of the unlucky ones. Many of Navalny's associates have received humanitarian visas to live in the EU, where they're relatively safe. Ivan Drobatov lives in Germany. He stays involved in activism from afar by sending letters to Russian political prisoners.
Можно рассказать человеку новости, прислать мемы или рассказать там что угодно, как-то там.
He says activists write them letters about what happened in the news, send them funny memes, or just describe ordinary moments outside prison, like taking a walk and stopping to pet a cat. Drobatov says writing these letters, it's an act of resistance that's still not illegal in Russia. Russians who formerly worked with Navalny are grateful for the refuge they found in the EU. But starting over, losing the work you loved, it is still rough. Yevgeny Karpov worked in Navalny's regional offices and now lives in France. He has two children in Russia from his first marriage, and he doesn't know when or if they'll be able to get visas to visit him. He says lots of activists who had to leave Russia, we feel this loneliness. You just want to go home. And that absence you constantly feel, that is the hardest part, he says. Many are making the best of it, though, raising money and finding donations to create online content about issues like corruption in Russia. They post videos on YouTube and Instagram, providing Russians with an alternative to Kremlin-controlled propaganda.
Вот посмотрите.
Октябрь 22 года. Губернатор Омской области Бурков.
In one recent YouTube video, a Russian man likens the corruption of Russian officials to the movie Groundhog Day. A clip from the film shows a young Bill Murray smashing an alarm clock as he wakes up again on the same damn Groundhog Day. The video's host, Daniil Chubykin, makes the point, this is what it's like living in Putin's Russia. Nothing ever changes. Chubykin used to be the associate director of Navalny's office in the Siberian city of Omsk. Chubykin says although he and many other Russians continue the online truth-telling that Navalny championed, the Russian opposition no longer has a unifying leader. They're kind of rudderless.
Я считаю, что это, конечно, никакая не случайная смерть и не там просто проблемы со здоровьем, это целенаправленная.
That is why they took out Navalny, he says. This was a targeted killing. It was done to create a vacuum in the opposition.
Который показал, что можно бороться.
Mourners gathered on the street in the Armenian capital, Yerevan, on the anniversary of Navalny's death. Children and 20-somethings in winter coats stand beside people old enough to be their grandparents. Orange candles glow before a flowered memorial with a sign that reads, Putin killed Navalny. A priest swings an incense holder, wafting black smoke, and recites a blessing. Colleagues of Yulia Yemelyanova, the former Navalny volunteer awaiting extradition in a Kazakh prison, sent me a video of this event. Her legal team has vowed to appeal her case. A Russian man who helped Ukrainian refugees with Yemelyanova says he is in shock that this happened to an activist outside Russia.
То есть теоретически нам это тоже может грозить. Хотя мы помогали только беженцам, а не армии.
He says, in theory, any of us could be targeted for helping Ukrainians. 2 years ago this week, the Russian government killed Navalny to stop the opposition. But his associates are still fighting. So far, neither side is backing down. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges.
A short note about a shark sighting, which should not make headlines, but this is different. A research camera captured the image of a 13-foot sleeper shark. So what, you say? Well, the camera was 1,600 feet down off the South Shetland Islands near the Antarctic Peninsula, and that is a big deal. Experts did not know that sharks ever ventured into the frigid waters off Antarctica. In fact, researchers tell the Associated Press that this is the first ever sighting of a shark in that part of the ocean. This is one small frame the camera took and in one specific location, so there could be lots of other sharks down there. They'd have lots to eat, treated to a virtual smorgasbord, carcasses of whales, giant squids, and other marine animals that die and sink to the bottom. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. For the first time in 15 years, the electoral prospects of Hungary's Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, hang in the balance. The right-wing populist leader is a longtime ally of President Trump. Now, less than 2 months ahead of national elections, Orban is facing a real threat from a center-right opposition candidate. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has more.
Hungary's election campaign has only just officially kicked off, and already it's getting ugly.
Hungary's opposition leader, Peter Mayer, has said that he was secretly taped having sex and has accused the government of trying to blackmail him ahead of key elections.
Peter Mayer, the main opposition candidate standing against Viktor Orban, said a few days ago that journalists in Hungary had received a photo of a bedroom with the message, "Coming soon." In a social media video, he said he suspects Orban's Fidesz party is planning to release a tape made using secret surveillance equipment of an intimate night he spent with an ex-girlfriend. Drugs were also in the apartment, he says, although he says he didn't take any.
Orbán Viktornak pedig azt üzenem, hogy 59 napja van hátra ennek az aljas.
I have this message for Viktor Orbán, Mayor says in the video. This evil, corrupt power has 59 days left. You'll not be able to intimidate or blackmail me, he says. The Fidesz party has denied any knowledge of the recording. Although it's not the first time Mayor's personal life has been the subject of allegations by pro-government media. So far, though, it doesn't seem to be doing him much damage.
He's a very talented politician. He's a charismatic politician. He has a lot of skill. He knows what to say, how to say it, and what not to say.
Zseke Csáky, who's Hungarian, is a senior fellow with the Centre for European Reform. Mayor has cut through, she says, where so many opposition candidates have failed because he knows how to play Orban at his own game. Mayor was once a member of the Fidesz party.
He worked in Brussels under the Fidesz government at some point, and he is the ex-husband of a former justice minister, so he knows that circle very well, and many voters see this as an advantage.
Mayor's campaign has focused mainly on Hungary's economy, which is struggling, and corruption. The European Union has withheld billions of funds from Hungary in recent years, citing concerns about corruption and the independence of the judiciary. Hungary is also ranked among the most corrupt countries in the EU by Transparency International.
I couldn't care less what Transparency International says.
András László is an MEP and a member of Orbán's Fidesz party.
Their methodology is totally fake, it's totally biased, and they have been campaigning against us for many, many years.
László says corruption isn't as much of an issue for Hungarian voters as the opposition wishes it was. The big issue, according to his party leader, Viktor Orbán, is the war in Ukraine.
A legfontosabb dilemma, amivel szembe találja magát a magyarság ebben a négy évben.
The most important dilemma Hungarians face in the next 4 years will be the question of war, Orbán said a few days ago, and a vote for Peter Mayor will drag Hungary into that war, he said. Mayor has dismissed those claims and says he agrees with Orbán that Hungary shouldn't send military aid to Ukraine or fast-track the country's EU membership. Still, Fidesz MEP András László says the war is what voters are most worried about.
Because we're a neighbour to Ukraine. Of course, the Ukraine war is the number one issue in Hungary. It impacts us very severely. It impacts the European economy very severely and impacts our economy very severely.
Kathleen Che, a left-leaning independent lawmaker in Budapest, sees it very differently. All this talk about war, she says, is a distraction tactic.
Every financial problem Hungary has been faced with was blamed on Ukraine. This is absolutely nonsense. These financial problems are created by Mr. Orbán himself because he did not do certain anti-corruption reforms, and as a result, he was cut from a great amount of EU financing. The blame is on him.
Che says she disagrees with Peter Mayor on lots of issues. But he's the only chance we've got, she says, to restore democracy in Hungary. Mayor, though, may have a steep hill to climb. Most television and radio outlets in Hungary are owned by allies of Viktor Orbán's. And political analyst Zseke Csáky says gerrymandering and other structural issues around the elections mean the odds are stacked against any opposition party.
Because of Hungary's electoral law and electoral system, experts estimate that the opposition would have to get around 3 to 5 percentage points more to actually win.
For some voters, neither Viktor Orbán nor Peter Mayor is the ideal choice.
In my view, we would simply be bringing another power-hungry leader to power if Peter Mayor were to win.
Nicoleta, a mother of four in Budapest, tells me there are few options for left-wing voters in this election. She doesn't want to say her full name, she says, for fear of being targeted. Two of Nicoleta's children are gay and her son is transgender. And under Viktor Orbán, Hungary has adopted some of the strictest anti-LGBTQ laws in the EU. Peter Mayor, who's also conservative, generally avoids the issue of gay rights on the campaign trail. Nicoletta says no matter who wins the election, some of her children will probably leave the country anyway.
I think a significant portion of young people have reached the point where they no longer believe in their future in this country. So, yes, my transgender son is thinking about moving, yes.
Still, she says, all of her children are planning to vote on April 12th. And even if we're not happy with the result, she says, at least we still have the right to cast our vote. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Life in Cuba is slowing down. In some places, it's almost come to a complete standstill. Blackouts are a daily thing. Tourist hotels sit nearly empty. Lots of international flights are grounded. Even the yearly Habano Cigar Festival that once brought in millions of dollars of revenue has been canceled. This has a lot to do with the fact that the Trump administration is cutting off oil shipments to Cuba. Journalist Ed Augustin sent us his voice memo today from Havana.
Pretty much all public transport's cancelled. The black market price of petrol has more than doubled in the last 2.5 weeks. Cubans are just having to stay at home increasingly because people can't afford private transport. But there's a mood of despondency mixed with, not to romanticise it, but stoicism, resistance. Despondency because there's lack of hope. There's a broad sense that things are going to get very, very bad here. But stoicism and a kind of shrugging, let's get on with it attitude, because of course they're hardly new to crises. A huge amount of the population have lived through it before in the 90s, when Cuba had even less petrol. People are bracing for the storm, but there's not a sense of panic.
Speaking to reporters yesterday on Air Force One, President Trump had this to say about the U.S. standoff with Cuba.
Well, we're talking to Cuba right now, and Marco Rubio talking to Cuba right now, and they should absolutely make a deal because it's a humanity. It's really a humanitarian threat. We'll see how it all turns out, but Cuba and us, we are talking.
But who is the Trump administration talking with in Cuba, and what is being discussed? Peter Kornbluh is the co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. He joined us today from Miami.
For a number of days now, President Trump has been repeatedly saying, we're talking to high-ranking Cubans. I think we're going to make a deal with Cuba. They should make a deal before it's too late. Cuban officials have said that there are no negotiations going on, but that there have been some sort of communications, perhaps initial messages passed. There have been rumored and not well-sourced stories about both the son and grandson of Raul Castro holding secret meetings with U.S. officials, including Marco Rubio. It would make sense that the two sides are using the back channel diplomacy to try and see if there is common ground. There is a long and deep history of back channel talks between Castro governments, Fidel Castro and Raul Castro. And 2 years of back channel diplomacy led to the incredible breakthrough between Raul Castro's government and the Obama administration just 10 years ago to normalize relations. So back channel diplomacy and negotiations between Cuba and the United States are both possible and I would argue preferable to end this current crisis.
What do you make of the certainty, though, from Washington and the very soft pedal from Havana?
Back channel diplomacy is just that, back channel diplomacy. Sensitive talks that are conducted out of the public eye so that the two sides have the most latitude to discuss things without the political pressures, particularly from the Cuban-American community in Miami, on Secretary of State Rubio and President Trump.
What has been suggested, though, is that talks, if they are happening, they're bypassing official Cuban government channels, which is not usually how things are done in Cuba, are they?
Well, who's to say how things are normally done in Cuba? The Cuban government is hardly transparent, but it would make sense that people around Raul Castro, who's widely considered the historic leader now after his brother passed away of the Cuban Revolution, it makes sense that people close to him would be the high-ranking Cubans that U.S. officials would consider credible messengers and emissaries from the Cuban side. I mean, certainly the U.S. government agencies aren't privy to these talks. Only the people who have, as they say in the lexicon of diplomacy and intelligence, the need to know. And on the Cuban side, I would guess it's the same thing. If this is going to stay a secret and work, be successful, you have to limit the amount of people who are involved.
Now, some reports suggest that back-channel negotiations are underway between Secretary Rubio and Raul Castro's grandson, who is 41. He's obviously from a very different generation. Raulito is how he's known in political circles by his nickname El Cangrejo, the crab. How much experience does he have in negotiations, if in fact that is what's happening?
I mean, I've never heard of him having any experience in negotiations. You know, talks are conducted at different levels. They can be just carrying messages back and forth. In the case of President Obama, he had two emissaries who met with Cuban officials, including the son of Raul Castro, Alejandro Castro Espín, for almost 2 years before that moment of an actual deal was arrived at. And at that point, both sides used the Vatican as an interlocutor to kind of lend credibility to a final agreement. It's not something that might happen fast. On the other side of this, though, the pressure that the United States is putting on Cuba economically is having a very rapid, deleterious impact, not only on the economy, but the Cuban people themselves. Cuba, if it is negotiating with the United States at this point, is negotiating with a U.S. dagger at its heart.
Well, I was wondering, the success of the U.S. military operation in Venezuela, aside from what it meant for oil to Cuba from Venezuela, how much did that shake up the Cuban leadership?
32 of its security personnel were killed when Nicolas Maduro was seized by Delta Force units in Caracas. They were a team basically of bodyguards and security guards for President Maduro, and they were all mowed down very quickly as the assault took place. Dozens of other Cuban officials and military personnel were actually injured from gunfire and explosions in that attack. It suffered the loss of its significant patron, Venezuela, both in Latin America and the world, and it suffered the loss of oil, which it needs to keep the lights on, to keep the cars running, to keep the water flowing from electric water pumps, to keep the hospitals operating.
I'm speaking with Peter Kornbluh at the National Security Archive about possible back-channel negotiations between Washington and Cuba. And the fact that U.S. troops killed those at least 32 Cuban intelligence and military officials when they captured Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, those Cubans were supposed to be guarding Maduro. How do you think Havana read that?
Well, obviously, the mission to safeguard Maduro failed. The United States military and special forces, such as the Delta Force, are quite formidable. And when they're used in surgical strikes that way, it's very difficult to oppose them. And overshadowing Cuba, going all the way back to 1961 and Bay of Pigs invasion, has been the threat of U.S. military intervention against the Cuban Revolution. And that threat is more real today than ever since the early 1960s.
Though Venezuela was a victim of regime change, it was not a victim of ideology change. How do you think Cubans see Washington's decision to keep Maduro's governing partners in power in Venezuela?
I think the Cubans have looked at that issue very carefully. And I think they understand that Trump really is not into ideology. He doesn't really care what the system of government is in Cuba. What he really cares about is economic openings and investment opportunities for his friends in the Cuban American community and for his own organization, the Trump Organization, in real estate and golf courses. And that, in some ways, should inspire hope that there is grounds for an agreement. And it may be in Cuba that there's a way to agree to something that seems similar to the status quo in government, but is significantly changed in terms of the economic situation in Cuba. And therein lies the grounds for a comprehensive deal.
Is there a figure equivalent to Venezuela's current leader, acting President Delcy Rodriguez, in Cuba? Can Washington find the next Delcy on the island?
The idea that the United States is going to find somebody to betray the rest of the Cuban government and kind of come on the U.S. side, I think is a false dream, a pipe dream. I think more likely that the Cubans will decide that they have a particular person who is worthy of negotiating with the United States, who perhaps the United States can live with in terms of kind of elevating the relationship between the United States and Cuba. And as collectively at the top of the Cuban leadership, there would be a decision of what to agree to. I do think there is the possibility of common ground between Cuba and the United States, and that dialogue is certainly preferable to ongoing U.S. economic and perhaps even more direct intervention on the island.
Do you think the White House has a plan, though, to avoid facing the Pottery Barn rule if Cuba turns into a worse disaster?
You know, you see little hints of the fact that they would prefer that not happen. For example, the U.S. government is going to allow private sector interests in Cuba to import their own oil. And the Cuban government is agreeing to that also. The private sector doesn't have a way to actually pay for an entire tanker, but they can start to import gas and perhaps keep parts of the private sector afloat. A lot of the private sector in Cuba, though, is tied to tourism, and Trump's policy is quickly shutting down the tourism industry because there's no oil to keep the lights on at the hotels, to pay for transportation. And now planes aren't flying from key tourist origins like Canada and even Russia.
Would instability in Cuba have broader implications for the Caribbean and Latin America?
Absolutely. Instability in Cuba will send thousands of Cubans onto small rafts. It could create a Cuban exodus into neighboring countries. It's not in the U.S. interest or in the interest of the rest of Latin America to see Cuba completely implode. And I think that quite a few Latin American countries understand that. I know the Chilean government has just appealed directly to Pope Leo for some type of Vatican intervention to help with the humanitarian crisis in Cuba. And I suspect other Latin American countries, including Mexico, will attempt to do the same. But you know, the situation is deteriorating quickly in Cuba, and it's important that U.S. government change this policy of pressure and adopt simply a more straightforward negotiating stance. Let's negotiate normal relations in which foreign investment is open, in which the economy is not overly controlled by the Communist Party and the Cuban military. And let's see a Cuban economy more open to development and modernizing, which would be in the interest of the Cuban people as well as our interests.
Peter Kornbluh is a senior analyst at the National Security Archive. He is also co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The fashion industry has more than a few environmental problems. In Europe, the annual emissions from destroying unsold inventory is the same as the overall emissions of the nation of Sweden. Many countries in the global north get rid of their textile waste by shipping it to the global south. Fashion and geopolitics expert Barbara Pino says the scale of the problem is like dumping a full garbage truck every second.
So if you think that, for example, in Kenya, they are receiving waste, textile waste and garments from 150 to 200 tons of textile waste per day.
But now the European Union has banned companies from destroying their unsold stock. When we spoke earlier today, Barbara Pino told me this is a good step, but the issue is complicated.
To understand how much unsold things, it can be a little bit tricky because maybe, for example, there are some things that goes to the second market or, for example, are going to be donations. So that part are not really defined in this new policy.
So what does it actually mean in this context to be destroyed, this inventory getting destroyed? Is it actually being burned or shredded or sent to a dump?
There is both, okay, but most of the time finish in landfills in the global south, like in Chile, Desierto de Atacama, or for example, in Kenya or in Ghana at Katamanto.
Are you saying that excess clothing is dumped in the Atacama Desert?
Oh, yeah. In these huge dumps, we can say it's almost one third that have the label. So it's unsold, also with the prices. So in somehow, the problem is that the global north keep the value by creating the meaning of fashion. Okay, and the global south absorbs the pollution that are the waste that are becoming to the other places in the world.
Right. So now with this new rule in the EU banning the destruction of most unsold clothing, what is supposed to happen instead?
Okay. One of the things that it's supposed is that they are going to control how much they produce. But this is something that it's not really... The problem is that we are focusing in the unsold things, not in how much you produce. So overproduction is going to still be a problem. And one of the other things is like how we are going to track what is going to happen with that clothes that are not sold, okay?
Yeah, is there an answer to that, how this will be monitored?
Oh, there is not really like a technical way to say, to keep track. The problem that we are going to have now is like how we are going to control the overproduction and how we are going to have unsold things if we don't control how many things we produce. Okay, because for example, you are not destroying your clothes if you send it as donation to some places on the world. And this is not banned.
So do you really expect this new law to bring about any change?
I think that in some way all is bringing, it's not that I'm fatalistic, but it's like, I think that it's like, I think that all things helps. Okay, I think that this is a good opportunity to make the European community talk and have a dialogue with other parts of the world on how this can be managed as a whole.
So what companies or kinds of retailers do you see this targeting? Like, who's going to have to find new ways of dealing with their inventory?
Okay, the most, and this is a good thing, for example, that the law has. It's like, first of all, its main focus in the large companies. And they are the most that are producing unsold products like H&M, Shane, Zara, and all that fast fashion and hyper fast fashion brands. Okay, the other things, the other companies are the medium-sized company. Okay, and this is going to be applied until 2030. So they are going to have time to reassess themselves. And the micro and small enterprises, they don't have like the artisans and the small fashion companies, industries that are so tiny. They are not going to have any problems because they usually don't produce anymore that amount of things that can be unsold. So this is a nice thing because maybe it's a call to just come back to a little slower way of having fashion.
Well, indeed. I mean, fast fashion for labels and retailers like H&M and Shein, it's kind of like betting on all the numbers on a roulette wheel instead of settling on a single color or hue or design for the season. How will this affect companies trying to plan their manufacturing?
Oh, I think that it's like, okay, this is something that it had been, France start with this in 2022. Okay, so most of the company are preparing themselves for this. Now we need to see how they are going to manage. And I think that the most visionary goal for them is just to rethink the whole complete circularity of clothes from textiles until they became waste. So I think that there's the change of vision of the business model, how this had been done up to now and how it can be up to the future on the way to go inside these new policies.
Barbara Pino is a professor of the geopolitics of fashion at Andrés Bello University. She joined us from Santiago, Chile. In a world that seems increasingly polarized, it's easy to forget that there are a lot of people trying to rise above the division, people who want to focus on the value of differences and the beauty of friendship. Cuban pianist Roberto Fonseca and French cellist Vincent Segal are doing just that. For years, Fonseca and Segal have traveled in similar music circles and played the same concert halls, but both admit they never really had the time to stop and really get to know one another. Someone needed to make the first move, so Roberto Fonseca suggested the obvious. They start by playing music together. His piano and Segal's cello could get the conversation going. So that's what they did. The result? Their album Nuit Parisienne à la Havane, or Parisian Night in Havana. Thank you. They recorded the album in Paris with no rehearsals and no specific plan. The music breathes easily and is symbolic of what they built, a lasting friendship built on spontaneity, respect, and the art of listening. How about that? Three pillars of any healthy relationship. New music there from pianist Roberto Fonseca and cellist Vincent Segal. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and more of our original reporting on YouTube at The World News GBH. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.